So if you will open your books with me to 1 Kings, we're starting a new book last week. And we were looking at the transfer of the kingdom from King David to Solomon. And last week we found out that David was old and well advanced in years, and he was bedridden. And for some reason he chose not to pass the throne on to his Solomon. And so his oldest surviving son, who was Adonijah, decided to take it upon himself and declare himself king. And I think last week I gave the sons out of order, and I apologize. Amnon was David's oldest son. Absalom was his third, and I think I had those two reversed last week. But Adonijah then declared himself king and went about with his own coronation. And we discovered as he was doing that, that Nathan the prophet came to David and made him aware. Now he did this in an interesting way. Normally he goes directly, but he used Solomon's mother Bathsheba to go. And we discovered she had a lot to lose, because if Adonijah became king, she would be the rival mother and would also probably be executed. And so he did it in the proper way. And as Solomon is sitting on the throne, Adonijah hears the noise and realizes that he now is the one who is being accused of treason. And so he runs to the temple and grabs a hold of the horn of the altar for sanctuary from the Lord. And we talked about this. This isn't a proper way that God said someone who had not committed murder could go and ask for the Lord's protection until he was able to have a trial. So that was according to the law, and Adonijah did that. And I was really amazed as I looked at this young man, Solomon. We know he's only 20 years of age at this point. And he is able to say to his brother, who's tried to usurp the throne, "I am reconciled to you. You can go home. It is now up to you whether or not you prove yourself worthy," which means one who is a good subject to the throne and one who follows my lead, "or whether you're evil," which means you come against me again. In the case that you're worthy, and I'm going to assume you will be, then you're free to live your life as you would like. But if you prove yourself evil, he said, then just be assured you will choose to die by the sword that day. So that's where our story left off last week, and we pick it up again in chapter 2, and we find that now the time grows near for David to die. We don't know how long it was between these two events. It could have been days, it could have been weeks, or even months between the time that David had Solomon anointed king and when he actually dies. But at this point, he gives a charge to Solomon, and this would be the passing on of the baton or the throne. And we've seen that done in the past. Moses passed it on to Joshua with a charge. Joshua didn't have an individual leader to pass it on, so he passed it on to the children of Israel with a charge. And then the last judge passed it on to the first king, Saul. And so we find David passing on now the charge to his son Solomon. And he tells him, he gives him both personal instructions as well as spiritual. He says, "Be strong and show yourself a man." What he's saying to Solomon is, go ahead and take control of your throne. Prove yourself to be a strong leader. Don't be wishy-washy. Establish yourself immediately. But he says there's a way that you do that. It's by observing what the Lord your God requires. And then he says to walk in his ways. This is a beautiful picture, because David knows very well God sees all he does. You remember the story of David and Bathsheba. David didn't tell anybody, right, but God knew. It's a picture of the king walking back and forth like parading, as you would a military parade, before the Lord. He says God sees everything that you do, and you're to walk according to his ways. Now, if you remember back in Deuteronomy chapter 17, God had given his laws regarding the kings. And one of the first things a king would do would be to copy the books of Moses, which are the first 5 books, in his own hand. He would then memorize that, and God would be able to draw it to memory. He says, the reason that you're to do this is so that you may prosper in all you do, and that the Lord may keep his promise to me. God had been very clear. His purpose is to have a relationship with his people. He says, the covenant that I made with you is for your benefit, not my benefit. And if you follow it, I will bless you. If you break it, there will be consequences. And the purpose is to draw you back into a relationship. David is reminding his son Solomon, you have a choice. You can be blessed if you obey God, or you can experience the consequences. The choice is really up to you. He mentions that he should do this so that he could keep his promise to me. Now, if you remember back to 2 Samuel 7, God gave an unconditional promise to David. He said, you will have a descendant on the throne forever. And that refers to Messiah. There was nothing David could do to either gain that or lose that. That was a promise of God. But in the case of blessings, That is up to the individual king in his line as to whether they obey or disobey. So that's what he was talking about. He says, if you follow the Lord with all your heart and with all your soul, what he's basically doing is the Shema, which I've been doing for you each week, which is Deuteronomy 5:6. He says, then you will never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. Well, following this instructions, he says, now there's a few people you need to know about. Imagine, Solomon's 20 years of age, very young, and he says, now, you know about Joab. We know about Joab. He's been an interesting character to meet, hasn't he? He's a very strong military leader, and he's very devoted to David, but he kind of does it his own way and his own thing. In fact, David, in probably 60 years, hasn't been able to deal with Joab. And he says, now, I want you to know about Joab. Deal with him according to your wisdom, but don't let his gray head go down to the grave in peace. I thought, oh, David, you couldn't deal with him in your life, so you give him off to your son to deal with him. And he says, but I don't want him to die a natural death. And he goes on to tell him that he was responsible for the death of two men during peacetime. And so there is blood on Joab's head, and Solomon needs to know this. He says, there's someone else, but this one you need to show kindness to. It's Barzillai of Gilead. And he says, I want the sons to be able to be among those who eat at your table. Now, the story of this is that David was fleeing from his son Absalom, who was trying to take control of the throne and kill David. And David had fled along with an entourage. Now, we assume it was a minimum of 500 people. There may have been more than 500 people in David's entourage. So he flees from his son Absalom, and he's out in the wilderness area with all these people. And Barzillai and a couple other men came alongside and provided everything that they needed in order to survive. And if you followed those lists, it didn't just include food. It included bedding, pottery, and of the food, all the grains, all the meat, all the milk, all the curds, and honey. That was a luxury item. But the king was used to having it. It would be like us inviting somebody over and giving them caviar. I mean, we don't necessarily have that on our table, but he was used to this. And he says, because Barzillai was willing to risk his life, because if Adonijah became king, he would have been executed. He says, he took out of what he had and made sure I was provided for. And now you, Solomon, I want you to make sure that his family is provided for all their life, because they took out of what they had in order to protect me and provide for me. And he says, and there's one more person named Shimei. He's a Benjaminite. He might cause you some trouble, Solomon, because when I was fleeing from Absalom, David is fleeing from Absalom, and along a ridge across from him, this guy Shimei is hurling insults at him, saying, David, you're getting just what you deserve. You know, God's punishing you because you stole the crown from Saul. He's a descendant of Saul, quite possibly in the line of Saul. He wanted to be king. And then he starts throwing rocks at David. And David's men say, can we go kill him? And he says, no. Because David wasn't sure whether this was from the Lord or not. He says, here, my son's coming against me. You know, what difference does it make if a Benjaminite is doing it? He says, it may be God's plan. No, let him live. Well, when Absalom is killed, incidentally, by Joab, and David is coming back to reign as king, we had to chuckle because the first one to greet the king is Shimei. He comes barreling down to the Jordan River, and he doesn't even stop at the river. He just plows right through there and runs over to David, falls before him and says, forgive me, you know, have mercy on me. He's asking for his life. And David's men standing next to him said, now can we kill him, you know, now that you're king again? And he says, no, no bloodshed today. But David knows as soon as he's out of the picture, he may come back and try to take the throne again. And so he forewarns Solomon and he says, don't consider him innocent, because he's not. I extended amnesty to him, not because he was innocent. You are a man of wisdom. This is verse 9. You will know what to do with him, but bring his gray head down to the grave in blood. I thought about this. David keeps calling upon Solomon's wisdom as he hands off all these difficult situations that he either was unable to or chose not to deal with. Verse 10, then David rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. This is a formula that we're going to see for every single king. It's going to announce the king's name, how he died, where he was buried, how long he reigned, and then who succeeded him in the throne. So the first one we see here is David. He rested with his fathers. Some versions say he was gathered to his fathers. That says he died a natural death. He wasn't murdered. It was peaceful. He was buried in the city of David. That's another way of saying Jerusalem. David built up a small section of the city, and he is buried there. And during the time of Peter, in Acts chapter 2, his tomb was well known, but we have no idea today where it is. He also reigned for 40 years, 7.5 in Hebron, and 33 from Jerusalem. Those are actual years. Quite often in the Bible it's rounded off, but in this case it's actual years. And he was succeeded by his son Solomon, who sat on his throne, and his rule was firmly established. At this point, we're told that Solomon's position as king is established. So David is now dead. And the first thing we read is, "And Adonijah," or "But Adonijah." Now, Adonijah hasn't given up yet. Interesting. Nathan went to Bathsheba, and she was the one that informed David of Adonijah's revolt. And now look what we have. Adonijah going to Bathsheba. And she says, "Do you come in peace?" I have a feeling she was kind of wary of this young man. He says, "Yes, I come in peace. Now you know, Bathsheba, that this kingdom was mine. I mean, I'm the oldest son. Everybody expected me to be king. But for some reason, God decided to give it to your son. Now I have this little request that I would like you to help me out with. You know, that Abishag, you know, the last beautiful young virgin that was brought to David, the one that's part of the harem but was a virgin?" He says, "Ask Solomon if I can have her for my wife. I wonder if he indicated, then I'll be out of your hair and everything will be just fine." So she goes to Solomon. Now I have a feeling Adonijah is still in the palace. I think this is happening immediately. It doesn't tell us all this, but in my mind's eye it does. And so she comes into the presence of her son, and I want you to notice the difference. Remember last week when she came into the presence of David? She bowed before him, and he extended his words and said, "What is it you wish?" She comes into the presence of Solomon standing, and he rises and bows to her. She has a very powerful position. She's the queen mother, and in her own rights, she's power. But Solomon respects and honors his mother. He has a throne brought, and she's at the right hand, the seat of power. And they sit together to have a conversation. And he says, "What is it that you want, mother? You know, anything you ask, I will give to you." And she says, "Well, I have this little itty-bitty request. It's for Adonijah." I'm sure Solomon went, "Oh, what's this?" And she says, "You know, Abishag, if you just give her to him as a wife, he'll be happy." Now, I don't know Solomon that well yet, but I have a feeling he's a young man that's under control. If it had been Joab or Adonijah, I have a feeling you probably could have heard his reaction, you know, down at the end at En-Rogel, or maybe certainly at the Pool of Gihon. But I think Solomon basically gritted his teeth and said, verse 22, "Why did you request Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? You might as well have asked for the kingdom." He doesn't give her a time to respond. And then he swears by the Lord, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if Adonijah does not pay with his life for this request. And now, as surely as the Lord lives, he who has established me securely on the throne of my father David and has founded a dynasty for me as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death today." Solomon takes an oath in the name of the Lord, saying, "If I don't carry this out today, then the Lord can do that to me." He had already warned Adonijah. He says, "Your life is in your hands. If you prove yourself worthy, you may live. If you prove yourself evil, you try to come against me again, let me forewarn you, you die that day by the sword." And so he gives a command to Benaiah, who's in there in his presence as the head of the bodyguard, to go deal with Adonijah. And I think he's still in the palace. And it ends right there for Adonijah. Solomon knows that Adonijah isn't alone, and so he sends for Abiathar. He's the priest right next door, because David has set up a tent with the ark next to the palace. Abiathar's brought into his presence. He says, "You're not innocent, you're guilty, because you've been part of this conspiracy." Can you imagine here? The high priest of the Lord going against the one the Lord has chosen to be king. He says, "You deserve to die, but because you've been faithful to my father, you will not die. But you can no longer serve the Lord. You have been stripped of your position. And you are banished from the city of Jerusalem," which also means the presence of the Lord. "But you can go to live 3 miles north of here, to Ahath," which was the place where the priests who were off duty lived. And you can live in the presence of those who are serving the Lord actively and be reminded of how you failed not only God, but me. Well, this fulfills, it says, what God had prophesied to Eli. Now remember, we got two high priests, which is very unusual, Zadok and Abiathar. Abiathar was the only surviving priest when Saul had come against the priests of Nob for giving David food when he was fleeing. Everyone was killed except Abiathar. Abiathar had fled to David while he was hiding in the wilderness, and David had made him his own priest. And when he came as king, he was given the position of high priest. He was actually a descendant of Aaron, who held that role, but he was a descendant of Aaron's son Ithamar. Zadok, who had remained in Jerusalem, was also a descendant of Aaron, but he was a descendant through Eleazar and Phinehas, which is the direct line. And so when David came, he brought Abiathar, and it was a dual role. But at this point, Eli was also descendant from Ithamar, and he had failed the Lord as high priest, and God had said that not one male would live long enough. He would be removed from office. And this is what we see here with Abiathar. Each will be given a choice, but each will sin and be removed from the office. Well, the news reaches Joab. Adonijah's dead. Abiathar's been deposed. I'm next. So what does Joab do? He figures if it worked for Adonijah, it's going to work for me. And he flees into the presence of the Lord and grabs a hold of the horns to ask for God's protection, sanctuary from the Lord. But the law in Deuteronomy said that was appropriate for one who had not committed murder. And we already know Joab committed murder. So Saul sends Benaiah to go deal with Joab. So Benaiah goes, and he's in the area where the tent of the Lord is and where the altar is. And he says to come out. And Joab says, no way I'm coming out. He says, I'd rather die here. Very interesting, because what he's actually saying is, I'm going to take a vow that I will commit the rest of my days to serve the Lord here. I give myself to God. In the New Testament, we have Anna that did that. That's the closest one I can think of. And so Benaiah goes back to Solomon and says, he's not going to leave. He said he'd rather die there. So Solomon says, okay. He can't ask for sanctuary from the Lord because he's guilty of murder, so kill him there. Why was he guilty of murder? He was guilty of the murder of both Abner and Amaziah. These were both people that had... Well, let me back up. Let me tell you the story very quickly. Saul and Ishbosheth. Ishbosheth was Saul's son, who was reigning as king of Israel, David's king of Judah, and they have a tussle between whose men are more important. And Joab has a younger brother, Ashel. And they were fighting each other, and Abner was running, and Ashel was trying to come up to him in battle. And he says, don't do this, because we're relatives. And he says, no, I'm going to keep pursuing you. And finally, Abner warns Ashel. He says, stop, or I'm going to have to kill you. And Ashel doesn't stop. And so Abner stops, plants his sword, and Ashel impales himself and dies there. Joab is his brother, even though this was during battle in which king was supreme, held Abner accountable for his brother's death, and he set up a plot later and kills Abner as an innocent person. The other one was Amaziah, when Absalom was revolting against David, and Joab actually kills Absalom. And then David comes back in order to reconcile everybody, I think because he's mad at Joab for killing his son, he makes Amaziah commander over the army. Joab doesn't appreciate losing his position, and so Joab sets another scenario up and kills Amaziah. So he was killing two innocent men, not in battle, so at that point he was guilty of murder. So Benaiah then goes there and kills him at the altar. It was appropriate. It was God's judgment being carried out. But I want you to notice something about him. He said he was also buried. He was not dishonored. God's judgment was carried about, but he was allowed to return to his family and be buried in honorable burial because he had served faithfully. Then we've got Shimei left, and the king sends for him. Now, this is not a very large area, so word travels quick. Adonijah's dead. Joab's dead. Abiathar's been removed from office. Solomon's paying David's debts off, and I'm next. So Shimei comes in, and Solomon says, build yourself a house in Jerusalem and live there, but do not go anywhere else. The day you leave and cross the Kidron Valley, you will be sure you will die, and your blood will be on your own head. Shimei says, oh, this is a good thing. I thought I was dead. And you've just extended me an olive branch, if you will. He says, I want you to build a house in Jerusalem, and basically you're under city arrest. You can't ever leave. Notice he said, if you ever crossed the Kidron Valley, if he crossed the Kidron Valley, he would be in his own tribal territory of Benjamin, where Saul came from. If he remains in Jerusalem, he's in the tribal territory of Judah. So he says, I don't want you going over there with your relatives and conspiring against me. So if you ever cross the Kidron, or if you ever go out of Jerusalem, you're dead. Shimei agrees, he takes an oath, and the years go on. Solomon doesn't do anything. Maybe he thinks he'll forget. And one day his slaves leave, and they go to Gath. So Shimei follows them, gets them, and brings them back. Well, word gets to Solomon. I have a feeling he was probably under constant surveillance. And he's brought before Solomon, and he says, why did you not keep your oath to the Lord? Verse 44, and the king said to Shimei, you know in your own heart all the wrong you did to my father David. Now the Lord will repay you for your wrongdoing. And 46, he gave orders to Benaiah, who went and struck him down and killed him. And now the kingdom was firmly established in Solomon's hands. Now it's a reality. Before the kingdom was his, there were no other contenders for the kingdom as far as the Lord and the people were. So we begin our story of Solomon's reign with chapter 3. But keep in mind, this is selective history, which means what we're learning is what God has given to us in order to understand God's story and how he related to his people. This isn't just Solomon's story, this is God's story. And as such, not every detail is in there, and it's not in chronological order. What he does in chapter 3, in the first three verses, is gives us the information we know to understand the stories that we're going to then read. So he starts out by telling us that Solomon made an alliance with the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. That doesn't happen until chapter 9, but it's an important piece of information. The writer of 1 Kings is telling us there's trouble ahead, and it happens because Solomon disobeys God's law. Now, God's law in both Deuteronomy 7 and Joshua 23 says that they weren't to intermarry with those who worshipped foreign gods. The reasons they weren't to intermarry with them is because they brought their gods with them. And when they brought their gods into Israel, Israel would turn from God to worship the gods. So God said, you can't intermarry. Now you go, wait a minute, what about Ruth and Rahab? They were foreigners. Yes, they were, but they didn't bring their gods. What they did is they turned from their gods to make the God of Israel their God. And then they were welcomed as part of the nation. So that's the difference. And it's important for us to know that. So Solomon's going to make an alliance with Pharaoh and marry his daughter. The next verse also gives us a little bit of information. Verse 2, the people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because the temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Now this is really important for us to understand, because as we continue through the Old Testament, high places are going to be associated with pagan worship. We need to understand at this point God is still working with a newborn nation, even though they're several hundred years of age. Not all the pieces are in place yet. We automatically assume, because they'd been giving the law, that they were following it. And I know we were so surprised when we got into the book of Joshua to find out in 40 years in the wilderness they had never circumcised. We thought, well, that's the law. But we discovered they hadn't been doing it. What the writer is telling us is that Israel is worshiping at high places, but they're worshiping Yahweh, the God of Israel, not pagans. So we need to keep that piece in mind. Until the temple is set up, they are worshiping God outdoors in high places, and we're going to see in a minute that that is not disobedience. It's just that all the pieces aren't together. After having said that, he goes to the story of Solomon. He says, Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes, except he offered sacrifices and burnt incense on the high places. Solomon is offering sacrifices to the Lord because he loves the Lord, but he's doing this at the high place. And then it goes on to say he went to Gibeon to offer sacrifices at the most important high place. Now, what's the deal with this? The most important high place was Gibeon because the tabernacle, the one that Moses had been given, the one where God's presence was to be, was actually at Gibeon. That was where it was called the tent of meeting or the tabernacle, and that's where they were to come and to worship the Lord. That was an appropriate place. But there's a problem. What's missing? The Ark of the Covenant. God is not there. The Ark of the Covenant was a symbol of God's presence. So the Ark had been taken from the tabernacle by David and brought to Jerusalem so it could be in his presence. So we've got the pieces separated. We've got the tabernacle with its pieces over here in Gibeon, and then we've got the Ark of the Covenant over there in Jerusalem in another tent. So Solomon goes to the tabernacle, and he offers what says 1,000 burnt offerings. The 1,000, a way of saying a lot. Sometimes numbers are rounded off, and in Hebrew, numbers are very important. But in this case, it means he brought a huge amount and offered up, thanking the Lord and also asking for his favor. Now, we know that this was okay for him to worship at this high place, because when we get to the next verse, the Lord responds to him. The Lord answers him. He appears to him in a dream. This was a way God talked to the people. Solomon responds to him, and he starts by speaking of the past, saying that God had showed great kindness to his family, and now God was extending it to his son, who was himself. But he realizes the awesome task of it. He says, I'm a servant to you, God, but you've given me a huge responsibility, and I'm just a little child. Age-wise, he's young and inexperienced. He's 20 years of age. We can document that. And he says, this is an awesome nation. How am I going to rule them? And so he asked that the Lord would give his servant a discerning heart for a specific purpose. He wants wisdom and a discerning heart so that he can govern God's people rightly. We see the motivation. We see the heart of Solomon at this point. Because he says, who's able to govern this great people of yours? And it says the Lord was pleased with Solomon. Solomon could have asked for anything. It had been Saul or Adonijah, I have a feeling it would have been a whole lot different. But God says, because you have asked to be a good ruler of my people and not asked for personal gain, I will also bless you with wealth and honor. And he says, I'm going to even go further than that. He says, if you promise, or if you do walk in my ways, if you observe all my laws, then in addition, I will give you long life. Solomon wakes up. He's over at Gibeon where the tabernacle is. The first thing he does is goes to Jerusalem to the presence of the Lord where the Ark of the Covenant is, the burnt offerings and the fellowship offerings. Now, this is different. The burnt offerings, again, is just thanking the Lord, giving everything to him. The fellowship offering was a portion was given to the Lord, and then the other portion was enjoyed by the worshiper. And in this case, he gave a great feast, and all of the court was there with him, acknowledging and thanking God because of his promise that he had given to Solomon. Very interesting. He asked for wisdom. He asked for wisdom. Your application question, I couldn't help but think, can we do that too? I mean, none of us are Solomon. None of us are ruling a kingdom, but every single one of us have difficulties in our lives. We all have families and people. We all need wisdom. We all need discerning hearts. And we looked in the book of James. Now, the book of James was conditional. It says, dear brothers, it's written to those who are children of God, those who have accepted God as the, you can ask of me what you will. And he specifically commands us to ask for wisdom. And he says, it will be given to you. Again, based on the motivation from your heart, just as Solomon's was. There's a lot more in James. I hope you have time to read it. But I thought, you know, these lessons are practical. And we can learn. True wisdom only comes from the Lord. And we have access to that same wisdom for our lives today. Let's pray. Lord, as we come before you, we just thank you for these stories. Your story, as we look at each. Thank you for the life of this young man, Solomon. 20 years of age, so young, such a heavy responsibility, and yet he knew that the only source of strength and wisdom comes from you. I pray that each one of us would be able to learn from Solomon, and that we too would turn all our concerns over to you, and that we would draw on you for our strength and our wisdom. You said that we could ask and come before you boldly, and so we do this. And we thank you and praise your name. Amen. Okay, now I had a couple things I wanted to share with you. One is I wanted to make sure you understood all the parts of the tabernacle. Do you understand that there's several places where they're worshiping at this point? We've got the tabernacle, which is the actual physical building, and that's over at Gibeon. It was at Shiloh. When the Philistines came against Shiloh to destroy it, the Israelites rescued the tabernacle and put it at Gibeon. But David, when he became king, well, actually, during that same battle, they took the Ark of the Covenant into battle with them because they thought God would give them victory. And the Philistines captured the Ark, and they took it, and they had all sorts of problems with it and sent it back. So the Ark actually was staying at a home in Kiriath-Jearim. But David wanted the presence of the Lord close to him, so he created another tent in Jerusalem next to the palace and brought the Ark of the Covenant there. So you got this separated, the tabernacle in Gibeon and the Ark in Jerusalem. So until Solomon builds his temple and all the pieces come together, it'll be hard to keep track of this. But I just want to make sure that we're all in sync. The Ark of the Covenant is a box made of acacia wood, inlaid with gold, with a solid lid, with two cherubim, or angels, with their wings touching. And that's called the mercy seat, the lid. And inside the Ark, at this particular time in history, is the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are on two tablets, not because there's five and five, but because it's the two contracting parties. One is God's copy, one is the people's copy, and because God's living with his people, both copies are in the Ark of the Covenant. At one time, there was the manna, and there was Aaron's rod that budded, but we found out a couple weeks ago that they aren't there anymore. Don't know what happened to them, but we know the Ten Commandments, the copy of the law, is in there. And that's what's in the tent next door to the palace. The Ark of the Covenant represents God's presence with his people, and that's where they would come to inquire of the Lord and to worship him.